Welcome to another flash edition of Musonomics, supported by Luminate. In New York, I'm Larry Miller from the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt.
And reporting live from Westchester, I'm Lynn Gonzalez, partner at the law firm of Granderson Day Roche. How you been, Larry?
It's been a very interesting couple of weeks here in higher ed in New York City. And I've been traveling around a little bit, too. I was in New Orleans for Jazz Fest. I was in Austin last weekend and getting ready to go to Nashville next week for Music Biz. What about you?
I have also been on the move. It's not summer vacation for me, unlike you, though, so I have to fit all this in while working. But I did get a chance to go up to Albany to do some lobbying with the Recording Academy yesterday around the RAP Act. That's the act that would prevent the use of lyrics in criminal prosecutions unless they meet certain standards. So I thought that was a good time and a good experience. Thanks for asking.
You bet. We'll be doing an earnings roundup today. We'll cover Live Nation, Universal Music Group, and UMG and TikTok, and what just happened there. We'll discuss HYBE and SiriusXM, which is facing some headwinds.
Well, that's a lot of stuff. Should we just get started with Live Nation?
Yeah, the company announced record first quarter revenue of $3.8 billion, up 21% over last year, and expect strong results from its arena and summer amphitheater business. The stock was up 7.2% on the news, this against the backdrop of increased regulatory scrutiny and hints about a possible DOJ lawsuit that could force Live Nation to break up its ticketing and concert promotion business. You might remember last month, the Wall Street Journal published a piece about the lawsuit, which could happen in May if it happens at all. CFO Joe Berchtold said in the Journal story that he didn't believe a breakup of Live Nation or Ticketmaster would be legally permissible. You might remember the Obama Department of Justice allowed the merger to go through back in 2010, and the company's been operating under a consent decree since then that is supposed to keep Live Nation from retaliating against venues that don't use its ticketing platform, Ticketmaster, as their ticketing platform.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it seems like that consent decree probably addressed the most material concerns, which was, you know, making sure that they weren't discriminating against those venues that weren't using their ticketing services. So I just don't see what basis they would have to force the sale. What do you think?
Well, for me, I really don't see what would be served by breaking up Live Nation and Ticketmaster. I think that there was a ton of misinformation about this, and that there would be, you know, little to no consumer benefit from demerging the two businesses. Ticketmaster would continue to be the dominant ticketing platform in the world. Live Nation would continue to be the world's largest presenter of concerts and tours and one of the major venue operators in the world. And I just don't get where the pony is in here for consumers if a breakup were forced by the Department of Justice. I just don't get it.
All right, well, moving on. UMG seems to have had quite a quarter. I'll get into the earnings, but I wanted to touch on UMG and the TikTok relationship overall. A deal's finally been reached, and while terms haven't been disclosed, especially with respect to how the revenue model will shift, it's been said that certain like AI-related concerns have been addressed, so more protection for an artist's likeness and keeping their identity from being misappropriated. It also seems like UMG was able to negotiate some improvements in the deal that provide for like more e-commerce opportunities, advertising credits, and data sharing, right? So these are non-monetary benefits, and hopefully these benefits will extend industry-wide as well as any other monetary benefits that they were able to negotiate. You know, as a market leader, we're hoping that this whole fight sets the pace for an improvement that applies to everyone, right? Certainly the artists and the songwriters and other labels that were affected by the ban, they've got to be breathing a sigh of relief to have the channel back. And to be honest, it didn't seem like TikTok suffered much through any of this. But as we know, they have bigger fish to fry and more important things to deal with, like that lawsuit that was just filed today against the United States government. They faced heavy criticism for the whole thing, the whole move against TikTok, especially while they had Taylor Swift running a massive campaign to promote her last album at the same time that they were fighting this battle. Fans and artists alike seem to really dislike the ban, and it's definitely a win all around that I think, you know, that they were able to get this sorted.
Let's get to the earnings.
So moving on to earnings, it looks like their shares are up 5% for this quarter after the renewed deal with TikTok, and it's just shy of the company's high over the last 52 weeks. So that's positive, but it's only a modest improvement since the initial IPO price. You know, their stock price is at a much higher place than it was at this time last year. But again, compared to the initial IPO launch, it hasn't gained much. It should be noted that these gains are being reported after massive layoffs at UMG that were said to have trimmed about $300 million in operating costs. Even with this news, though, of the improved stock price, there's reporting that suggests the company may be facing a potential investor revolt. And that's based in part on the company's CEO's tremendous compensation package for 2023. Lucian Grange in 2023 took over $150 million for his work under a structure that paid him a smaller salary but had huge stock incentives, like two-thirds of that were based on stock incentives. I'm not the best at math, but it sounds to me like his salary was about half of the savings that was gained by laying off a substantial chunk of staff. So to me, that's concerning, and apparently to the shareholders as well. We'll see what happens. There was lots of opposition to the pay structure from shareholders when it was, you know, being discussed for 2023, but it was ultimately approved. Grange's contract goes through 2028, so we'll get a sense of how the investors react to this pay structure when they have to talk about it in their annual shareholders meeting as they prep for 2024's compensation.
Who says there's no money in music?
I mean, he did get $50 million in straight salary. All right, so what exactly is going on over there at Hybe?
Okay, Hybe, the public company that is Scooter Braun's current home and the home of K-pop supergroup BTS, posted their first quarter revenue too. It was down 12.1% with operating profit down 72.6% from this quarter last year. The stock fell over 12% last week on news that Hybe reported the CEO of one of their labels, Adore, to the police for breach of trust and other allegations. Concert revenue was up, but recorded music revenue, merch, and licensing, and its content segment were all way down.
Yeah, I mean, if I remember correctly, I think BTS is still in the middle of its military service. I can imagine that they are eagerly awaiting their return so they can get a new BTS record and get back on track. I mean, with such a marquee group at the company being out of commission, that's got to be a challenge. Speaking of challenges, we should talk about Sirius as well. I hear they're hitting some turbulence.
Yeah, you know, when you buy or lease a new car, you get a free trial of SiriusXM service. And last year, the company finished the year with 33.8 million self-paying subscribers, but they lost 445,000 for the full year, so self-paying car subs are declining. This week, Sirius stock fell after first quarter earnings were released showing self-pay subs dropped another 1.4%. Last fall, the company launched a streaming-only service. Why? Well, to try to compete with the digital service providers that are favored by younger audiences. I don't know about you, Lynn, but I don't know any, say, 18 to 24-year-old people that are subscribing to SiriusXM for their cars.
I don't know any 18 or 24-year-old people in New York City with cars, so I can't even speak to that. Man, I just like to be able to use my Sirius in the house, like just be able to listen to it at home.
Fact is, you already can. And the fact that you are a paying Sirius subscriber and that you didn't already know that, it's kind of a business problem for SiriusXM.
So are you going to teach me or no?
Yeah, I'll be right over.
All right, thanks.
Lynn, what's up with Kendrick and Drake?
Oh, Kendrick Lamar and Drake. This has been a fascinating entry in the hip-hop beef experience. So, I mean, I would say Kendrick Lamar and Drake have entered one of the fiercest hip-hop battles that we've seen in a long time. Obviously, there's been some notable beefs in hip-hop history, but none have had the impact that this one is having because of just the size of the stars involved, the technology that's available now, and the speed within which they've been releasing music. It's dizzying. Drake's had some, you know, opponents in the past. He's gone up against Meek Mill. He's gone up against Pusha T. And there's been, you know, obviously bigger beefs in hip hop history. Biggie and Tupac being like the marquee beef. That sounds weird to say. But this one's, you know, two of the biggest superstars right now. And I can run you through the timeline of like the records that have come out if you'd like.
Yeah, what actually happened?
You know, for a while, Drake, Kendrick, and J. Cole had been seen as the new big three in hip hop. And Kendrick is definitely trying to pull himself out of that comparison on a song that came out with Future and Metro Boomin on their album titled Like That. Kendrick says, basically, forget the big three. It's just Big Me. And that basically set off this whole beef. That Future Metro Boomin record came out on March 22nd. Drake responded with this Push-Ups record on April 13th. And there was no reply from Kendrick. After that, there was another, you know, track from Drake taunting Kendrick for his delay and suggesting he was, you know, slowing down his release to give Taylor Swift time to come out and pass. And that came out on April 19th. That was a song that used the AI Tupac and Snoop voices, so that was, you know, controversial on its own. Kendrick applied with an absolute scorcher of a track called Euphoria on April 30th, and then the weekend of May 3rd, that's when things really got heated. It got a bit personal. Kendrick dropped a song called 616 in LA. Drake came back the very same day with a record called Family Matters. That was almost immediately, like within the hours, followed by Kendrick's Meet the Grams. Kendrick then came out with an absolute bop titled Not Like Us on, like, it was hours after that, but technically I think May 4th. On May 5th, Drake put out a record called The Heart Part 6, and I think that may be the end of the beef, but we'll see. Some of the content got a bit personal and upsetting, like there were allegations of pedophilia, domestic violence. I think someone told someone's mom that they wish they were dead. We've never seen this sort of a timeline in rap beef, and it was all made possible by kind of these technological advancements that have been made for music delivery and release. So it's fascinating to watch.
Yeah. I mean, if you are unable to write, record, produce, mix, master, and then release a project on the same day, then you can't have this sort of timeline in a rap beef or any other kind of beef.
That's true. You know, a new entry and a new thing that's happened in this rap beef that hadn't happened before is Metro Boomin has put up a track that he's made it an open contest. It's, you know, he's obviously a very well-known and, you know, notoriously great producer. And he's put up a free beat and asked people to make songs dissing Drake over that beat. And whoever makes the best diss track will get a free Metro Boomin beat. I thought that was a unique way to approach it.
Are you going to be making your own version of the track?
If I can find some really good AI to help me, perhaps.
Lynn, did you notice when Spotify added audiobooks to your feed late last year?
Yes, sure.
Have you listened to any?
Not on Spotify. That's not my preferred platform for audiobooks, but I listen to them.
Yeah, so we talked about this a little bit last time. I paid attention when Spotify started offering up audiobooks, and I've listened to a few now on Spotify's platform, and at the time, it didn't occur to me what impact it would have for Spotify to bundle audiobooks with its music subscriptions. And now it's become quite a bit more clear. Longtime Musonomics listeners know that the Copyright Royalty Board, a tribunal of three federal judges in Washington, periodically sets rates for mechanical streaming royalties, among other rates. So the rates that streaming services pay songwriters and music publishers is regulated. The last settlement that took effect at the beginning of 2023 phased in rates of about 15% of applicable streaming revenues for the time period between 2023 and 2027. Now, Spotify is combining music and audiobooks together to pay less per stream to songwriters, music publishers, and performing rights organizations. They're doing this by bundling music and audiobooks into a premium subscription service that most of us already subscribe to at, I think it's $11.99 a month now. And so all of its existing premium subscribers in the United States are being told that they're now subscribing to music plus audiobooks. And if they want to change to just music or just audiobooks, they'll have to do that manually. So I spoke with Brad Sharp at Virtu Global about this. And in Virtu's analysis, royalties paid by Spotify under this plan might decline by 20 to 40%. That's a lot. Now, David Israelite and our friends at the NMPA think Spotify is acting in bad faith and not adhering to the CRB settlement. Whatever happens, the decline in mechanical royalties paid by the dominant streaming platform will introduce some volatility into music catalog valuations, possibly causing some catalog valuations to decline for revenues earned through the current CRB rate period that extends to 2027.
You know, I thought about this in the context of it just, you know, taking money out of the actual writer's hands right now, but I hadn't thought about the spillover into valuations, and that's interesting to think about. I mean, where deals are already done and predictions were made, this could really shake up that market a bit.
Yep, and I think there are going to be some adjustments in the foreseeable future, although I don't think the music publishers are going to take this sitting down, and we're anticipating some litigation over this.
I'm sure.
That's it for this week. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
From the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt, I'm Larry Miller.
And from GDR, I am Lynn Gonzalez.
This Musonomics podcast was executive produced by Lars Murray, technical production by Isaac Gaines. If you like what you heard, share the episode with a friend and be sure to follow us wherever you get your pod so you don't ever miss a new episode. And while you're at it, please give us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts because it really helps new listeners find the podcast. Once again, thanks to Luminate for their support on this episode. And thank you for listening.